I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Howard Mackenzie Murray. Welcome, Howard.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, some people say, Howard's on. Howard's on. You have to stop near Howard. And others will be saying, well, who's Howard? Well, let me do the intro properly. Howard has just had published his first novel by Fremantle Press with a fabulous title, This Is Where We Say Goodbye. And Marty Donald is quoted immediately on the front saying, quote unquote, remarkable, a funny, heartrending fever dream of a book. Now, how do you feel? You must feel great putting words into your mouth.
I do. I feel great. And that particular quote as well was the absolute highlight for me, because Marty Donald is one of my favourite Australian musicians. And so to get a nice quote like that from him, that meant a lot.
Well, I am very lucky that Fremantle Press gave me a bit of an advance. And of course, we all know when you get into creative writing that the first sentence, the first paragraph is prime real estate. And so I hit the very first paragraph, and I'm just going to read it out because it totally hooked me, Howard. I honestly don't know where the frig to start, guys. All I want to do is tell you about this one day last September when I snapped like a twig, my 21st birthday actually. But the problem is that it makes me think of something that happened before, and that reminds me of something else. And the next thing you know, I'll be giving you a minute-by-minute account of me as a fetus. Maud, the fetus. That'd be great. Just the diary of this tiny, beautiful fetus, wondering what the world's going to be like and getting excited for the big day. I wonder if fetuses do get excited. I wouldn't put it past them. You think they're putting their feet up there, but they actually don't stop. You're probably never busier in your whole life than when you're a fetus. That's a medical fact. You can trust me. I'm basically a doctor. Congratulations. That is one of the best opening paragraphs I reckon I've read in ages.
Oh, that's so sweet of you. Thank you. And I want you to do the audiobook.
It's a great start. You want to know, and it tells you so much. There's Maud. I'm basically a doctor. Is she the idea of a fetus having thoughts? I mean, the whole thing gets you going, and there's a story to be told here. How did you get into this writing business?
Oh, a long time ago. In fact, I was studying law. I was in my third year, and I gave it up because I just was always writing, and it was always eating away at my studying time. And I just knew that that's where my heart was. So I broke the news to some broken-hearted parents and friends and stuff, and that was sort of where I really began making it sort of my life vocation. Maud was still a long way away. She was still 10 or 15 years off. I was just working on getting better.
And so how do you do that? Cue young listeners, how to become a writer. How did you sort of discipline yourself or teach yourself? Obviously, we'd read a lot, but do you learn a lot from reading? Do you go to classes? Do you talk to peers? How do you do it?
Back in those days, it was reading. I was hooked on my early loves were F. Scott Fitzgerald, Hemingway, the sort of obvious choices of a 18, 19, 20-year-old. Like, they always seem to be the ones that crop up, Bukowski. And I wasn't very much of a critical reader, I think. I used to read for the love of it, and it meant that my early writing, I don't know how much raw talent was there. I would show people, I'd show friends and family my writing, and I think they had a hard time kind of finding the positives in it and stuff like that. But I was just like, I was hell-bent on the writing life. I wanted to live the Hemingway life. I wanted to drink wine in Paris and all of this sort of stuff. And it was all part of it for me. And I was determined that was what I was going to do. It also meant like reading lots of Paris Review interviews with all the writers. That was a great place for me to go and just like learn stuff, but also just keep up your morale, because the writing process is very slow. Like, learning your craft is very, very slow. like a lot of like apprenticeship periods, very long-winded. And I think keeping your morale up, keeping interested, keeping the passion there is a big part of it. So reading interviews was a huge part for me.
Oh, so it sounds like to some extent you followed in the footsteps of some of them. I must say, when I've been travelling around Europe at different times, they tell me Steinbeck slept here and Hemingway watched The Bull over here and all that sort of stuff. Did you do all that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I've got plenty more to come as well. But all the dumb stuff, I've slept under so many bridges and benches in parks around Europe. And a big part of that was inspired by the poverty of the lost generation.
This book, this is when where we say goodbye, was shortlisted. The manuscript was shortlisted for the Hungerford 2 years ago, which on its own is a fabulous feat. It means the judges sat up and said, hey, this is one of the ones we're going to be choosing from. And no doubt the process of getting it written took a while, but where did the particular inspiration for this book come from? And before you answer that question, to the extent that we are prepared to tell the listeners what the book's about, but just enough to entice them to make sure they come and read it, what's the book about?
Yeah, okay. The single motivation, the drive for me, the whole engine of this book, I think, is the narrator Maud and her voice, her personality. So she narrates it first person. The plot, fairly superficial sort of plot, is like Maud is a 21-year-old med student in Fremantle, and the book opens with Maud. Oh, she's depressed, wet, bedraggled. She's in Frio and there's a storm. And so she goes into a laundromat to sort of seek shelter from it, but also to write her brother a letter. And the following day, the whole book is written in about 24-hour period. It takes place in 24-hour period. The following day is Maud going to the funeral for the brother that she's writing this letter to. And it's a sort of comic, picaresque route that she takes. Episodic route that she takes to her brother's funeral, sort of just encountering lots of different trials and people along the way. But yeah, the inspiration for me was to try to really produce a true and genuine voice and a real person that when you push and prod it remains.
So I'm not allowed to mention James Joyce and Ulysses.
That's exactly. So actually, more the original Odyssey was the provides the sort of narrative archetype for this. So it's just like exactly as you said, it's like a roaming, it's a roaming story about nostalgia, about going home.
And in a day.
Set in a day, exactly.
And a woman, and I was having this conversation with a friend the other day. I said, I'm reading this book, and I said, and it's a male writer. And the key person in this book is a woman, relatively young woman, I'm guessing, you know, probably about your age. She's had all sorts of experiences, and she finds herself living a little bit away from the madding crowds. And this challenge of a man writing with a woman's voice or with a woman's view or from the perspective of the female player, and to an extent or to a large extent, you've got Maud, a woman, that age, med student. Was that a challenge?
Yeah, I mean, it was a challenge. It was also like a wonderful period of my life. Like when I was writing this, I carried this book around with me for about six years. It was like maybe 5 years of that was intense writing. And there was maybe a year of just kind of wafting. But I would say to people like, and I think it's still true now when I think about it, I would say to people, this book is less writing, more, I felt like a method actor. It was more about becoming Maud and then just doing it with a pen in my hand and letting her speak and just letting that flow out of me. So it was an experience of writing where a lot of the work that I put into that book happened outside of the book. It happened like when I was just walking around town. I took that from Paris to Melbourne to Fremantle, and it was I sort of had to become more. I think if a character is real in that way, and if they're carrying the whole story, I think you have to be very intimate with them. So that was the major challenge, and it was a beautiful thing, and it changed my life, I think.
The other thing that a lot of people go through, but fortunately don't go through it too often, is grief, experiencing the loss of someone close. It could be a parent. It could be a grandparent. It could be, if you are a parent or a grandparent, a child. It could be just the awful thing of seeing someone killed on the road in a terrible accident. Mm. But here you've got this relationship, as you've already explained, that there's a funeral happening. There's a whole question of grief. How does one go about writing about grief? I could write about grief. It would be deeply dependent on personal experience. But how do you go about taking grief as a concept, working it into a book, and balancing it so that it's part of what you've done in the book?
To piggyback on the last answer of spending that much time as Maud, I think there's an amount of, I think this is the first time working in with this book, this is where we say goodbye, where I stopped being so, I think like my cardinal sin is with writing is being willful, being too willful. And it's like trying to know what's going to happen ahead of time. So with this book, and in trying to like inhabit Maud fully, it was more a question of letting it flow out. So Maud is she's in it. She's in the hole of grief. More grief than a body can take, than a single nervous system can take. She cannot process it. And so, I mean, it was just a matter of sitting in that space and just writing. And I mean, I wrote so much and got it down to this. So it was a huge amount of editorial work after the fact, because Maud just spewed it out, you know what I mean? And I was just there for it, writing it down. Afterwards came the process of editing it and making it sort of, hopefully, a cohesive whole. But I think that's kind of how I worked it.
It's a great title. I always like to learn about titles. I've seen a few manuscripts and interviewed a few writers doing their first, and I always wonder whether the editors are going to get hold of it and change the cover and change the title, and necessarily they'll move some of the words around. But how did you find the whole process of producing the book?
It was really exciting. It was one of the first times, and certainly the first major time, where I had worked with professionals. And I mean, early on in your career, that's like I said, it's writing was something I did for a good 15 solid years before I sort of took something and showed it to the world. And it's funny and a little bit hard to carry something that means so much to you, that actually doesn't have much play with the world. You don't I've written books. They weren't very good, short stories and stuff like that. But I kept them all to myself. And you know, after a while, people sort of go, "Are you still doing that thing? Are you still writing? Like, haven't you given it up?" And so it's nice after that long to sit down with professionals and to work with each other, and for them to read the book and give feedback and make it better. It's like it's hugely validating.
They may or may not have asked you the question in the early stages, but here it is. when you started on this, and at least when you finished it, put the final period mark at the end, and wrote a couple of little thank yous and acknowledgements, who were you writing the book for? You'll probably tell me for yourself, but who else?
You know what? I enjoyed writing the book, but I didn't write the book. I didn't really write the book for, well, you know what? It's funny. Different people as it goes along. I had in my head in the early days, a kind of like blurry, vague 14, 15, 16-year-old who I think is something like me at when I was 15. Just kind of like, surely this can't be real. This world cannot be real. Like this is a circus. This is a carnival, and I seem to be the only one who sees that it's just a big joke. Very adolescent, you know, kind of way of seeing the world, which I basically still have today.
Oh, I'm pleased to hear it.
Yeah. And that comes with a huge amount of alienation. It comes with a huge amount of solitude, you know, because you get thinking, like, am I the only one who sees this? Am I mad? Am I not? Plus, I was just a kid kicking around school without any friends. So I thought about this kid in school who didn't have any friends and who was just sort of thumbing through the library and found this book and could maybe just get like a sense of you're not alone. There's other people who see the world in a similar way.
Well, it's a lovely answer, Howard, because writers have a special place, as I see it, in our culture, in our world. We like the idea, I think, that the writer has a vision of the world, where they see this crazy circus and carnival going on and think, does everyone else see that? And we want them, I think, also, in that sense, to stay true to this vision, because from that we learn ourselves to stop, to think, to look through your eyes. Are there some special lessons, I suppose, you want that kid who happens upon the book in the library to draw from the book?
Oh, that's a good question. You know what? I don't know if I think I'm particularly wise in any way or have that much to offer in terms of solutions. I think what I really want to do is get comfortable with someone who's young, in young and sad. Because when you're young and sad, you have this like, there's this disparity. You're often intensely sensitive. Everything's happening for the first time to you. And I don't know about you, but when I was, you know, 15, 16, and I was going through, you know, like breaking up with someone for the first time, and, you know, the first goodbyes and stuff like that, you think that has never happened before in the universe. No one has ever felt this way ever before. They're huge emotions. And yet, same token, you don't have the experience to put those emotions into any kind of context. You don't have any tools to deal with it at all. It's an intense period of people's lives, you know what I mean? And so I wanted to create someone who was like vividly in that place, just young and so sad, and just to sit there with them, you know, just to sit there with them. And so when that 14, 15, 16-year-old in the library in my head comes across this book, they just get that sense of someone else has been here before.
Someone understands me.
Yeah.
It's a great concept. In fact, my other pet theory is that people should be writing for the 15 and 16-year-old, because if they do, somehow they're going to communicate with everybody. Older people, chronologically older, are going to get it as well. I mean, you don't have to write Ulysses to get attention to convey what you're writing, but you're also just describing things, and that has its own lesson, doesn't it? Just talking about what's going on in the world.
Yeah, I think so. I think when I see it today. You know, everyone wants a little bit of validation that this is bonkers. You know, you look at the news, particularly, you know, now, and I don't know, I've only 37 years context, so maybe the world has always felt this unstable. I'm not sure. It's very crazy. And I think people look around at each other and they're hoping that they find in other people's eyes, like, yes, you're not alone. This is bonkers. And it's hard. So I think it matters in that way, of just making people feel a little bit more like they're not alone.
Well, if they go and see Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey, they'll quickly come to the realisation it's been going on a fair while.
Yeah, exactly.
But what are your writing habits? That's the other thing I'd love to find out from writers, young and old, new and very experienced. Do you lock yourself away in a closet out the back of some share house? Do you have a garden shed somewhere on a plot? How do you do it?
Right now I'm blessed with having, I've just got a small apartment where I live alone, and I can, so like I'm ridiculous. I think a lot of writers seem to be like they zero in on it and they're very habitual. So like I'm embarrassingly habitual. I sort of hate it about myself, you know, like it's not that sexy, but I wake up at the same-ish time. I read poetry. That's how I start the day. I've got a stack of poetry. So I read that for an hour. I drink my coffee. And then I write. I just write for about 6 hours a day, every day. And then I go and have my afternoon to myself.
I love to hear that. I've read various things about various famous writers, but inevitably they follow that mantra of yours, that ritual. And they go wherever it is they go, and they write X thousand words, or they write for X number of hours. You just have to do it, don't you? You just have to put the words on the paper and work through your thoughts with Maud or whomever.
I think so. I think it often comes up in conversation with people when I'm encouraging them to sit down and write, because it's a difficult thing to do. I'm in the habit of it, so it's easier.
Mm.
But people are... I know people who are just sort of trying to write their memoirs, or they're trying to get in the habit of sitting down with a blank page, and it's daunting and it's terrifying to them. And the Picasso quote of like, you know, about whenever inspiration strikes, it's always when I'm at the easel. And so you have to be sitting down. You just have to be there to catch the butterfly when it comes through. And you sometimes, you know, it's all day, all week, nothing comes. And but when it finally does, you go, it was all worth it.
So I'm taking from all of this how there's no plans to return to law school to complete that degree.
No, I think not.
Rather, there's probably one or two or three works actually or potentially in the mind that are on the go at any one time, are there?
There is. It's a little bit messy for me at the moment. I'm like working on some short works. I love the short story form. And they're also just a good little laboratory for bigger things. So I'm working on a few short stories to kind of get a nice collection together. And in the meantime, I'm also slowly working on a novel of more speculative fiction.
And in that literary sense, just explain to our listeners what the difference is for you between the product of the short story and the product of novella stroke novel, the longer work. Is one more satisfying to you? Should the reader find one more satisfying to them? I mean, how do these things work? I have to tell you straight off, I love picking up a good set of short stories, and sometimes I like it when somehow or another the stories are actually connected, even if just by character or place.
I do too. I'm not sure. I don't. There's no prescription for me. I mean, I just, like I said about Fitzgerald, I love The Great Gatsby. That is a short novel, but it has this feeling of a short story. I don't even know what that means. I think it's a simplicity of conceit, or a simplicity of structure, also just a brevity. But it's nice just to sit down and be able to, from start to finish, finish a story in a you know single afternoon or an hour. It has a kind of impact or a punch that a novel just probably won't. But then with a novel, you know, you get to spend time with these characters, and like, I don't know about you, but like right now it's winter and I'm into Raymond Chandler, who's a big influence for me. And it's just the perfect time to like, to get cozy up in a bed, grab my one of the stack of Raymond Chandler's that I've got, and just to dig back into the same characters, you know, it's just nice to spend time with them.
No, it absolutely is. When I was about 14 or 15, I think, coming home on school holidays in the goldfields, somebody introduced me to James Bond. And I learned so much about culture, apart from everything else that Bond got up to. I was having shark fin soup and in Japan. And, oh, my goodness, I didn't need to go to Paris and trace things down. I was learning in country Western Australia. But who are the other influences for you? You tick a certain number off. Who, when you were younger, you thought, oh, my God, this is great. You've mentioned well, who?
Yeah. In the early days, it was those kind of obvious choices of the Lost Generation. For some reason, they seem to recur for young writers. Not sure exactly why, but I was...
You have to read them.
Yeah, you got to read them. Yeah.
Not drink so heavily.
Yeah. Well, it's a good time. Yeah, it's a good time because you can learn from your mistakes. And then I think you get a little bit older. These days, it's a lot of poetry that I drink. And in the early days for me, the influences were more like I just want to write like Hemingway. I would just produce nothing but Hemingway short stories. These days, it's the relationship between what I read and what I write is much more vague. Right now, I'm reading Nellie Sachs, who is she's a Holocaust survivor poet, an amazing poet who just deals a lot with grief. Sort of everything she touched, everything she wrote was basically a commemoration of that whole period. And somehow it's all sort of finding a way into my writing, but the poets like Paul Celan, Pablo Neruda, Czesław Miłosz, these are all people I spend a lot of time with.
You could, of course, these days, speak to Claude or ChatGPT or Copilot or DeepSeek, any one of them, and say, I'm crazy about this guy. Can you write me a short novel in that style? And they probably would. You give them a few key points. How are you thinking about this whole world that lies ahead of you? I'm twice your age. I think about it, but I don't have to worry about it. How are you starting to come to grips with AI and literature and writing and everything else?
Yeah, I think it throws me back on what I do it for. I just go, everything seems up for grabs at the moment. Right now, AI software seems capable of sort of identifying AI-generated material. I'm not sure if that's going to be true in the future. And so that means, as far as I can see, it's like a total breakdown of the way the industry works. And so you can fall into that pit of speculation. It's just an infinite pit of speculation, which is pretty worrying, you know? So it throws me back on. I love writing. Like, I'm just going to keep writing. And then if everything burns down, and I don't think that'll happen, but if everything burns, I get to sit, you know, at my desk for 6 hours a day. I get to read my poetry, and I get to sit there with coffee and write. That's pretty good.
Well, Howard, it's been lovely meeting you. This podcast interview will go up in Fremantle Shipping News. People are going to want to read this. They know that they can come down here to Fremantle Press in Parry Street in the centre of Fremantle and buy it. They can also go into good bookshops around Frio and elsewhere, and they can buy it online, which is fabulous, and it's not far from Christmas. It's going to touch a lot of hearts, your book. Are you ready for becoming celebrated.
For the big time. I'm ready. I'm here for it.
And then you'll have to be meeting deadlines. Can't take 5 years.
No, I'm already working on the next one.
Are you finding that that sort of discipline, writing in a sense under pressure, is well, it's just par for the course, I suppose, something you just have to be good at?
It's a funny one. It's a good question. I never had to before, and in a sense I don't have to now. It's not as if publishers are knocking on my door asking for the next chapter, but at the same time, you write with a sense of with a greater sense of there being eyes on what's to come. And fortunately, I think that just having a discipline in place of sitting down and writing sort of just means, like, you know, you work your way through it and it all starts to come back to the writing again.
And to finish, what's been the 1, 2, 10 things, as many as you like or as few, that you've really learned, whether it's about yourself, probably more about this whole process of writing, in producing This Is Where We Say Goodbye?
I've learned that I'm a bit of a sucker for, you know, a couple of times people have come up to me and said, hey, love your book. And it meant a lot more to me than I thought, than I was willing to admit that, you know, that it would. It's really, really lovely to connect to people. As much as I would have said, I'm just writing it for me, I love, you know, doing this, it's such a nice thing to be connected with people, to work with people, professionals, people who I really respect. It's gorgeous, yeah.
Well, it's been well received. Congratulations, and we look forward to the next one.
Thanks so much, and thanks for having me.